which I filled to the brim with water for the dogs. As I was doing this, Leo stood up too. I could hear his knees cracking from across the room. He walked silently, though. He moved on padded soles across rugs. Not a single window was open, though it was hot this time of day and very humid. There was a strong smell in the house I hadn't noticed a week back, when I'd been there last. It was not a bad smell, just intimate and particular. Faintly sweet, full of unexceptional secrets, ripe fruit, kitty litter, laundry detergent, maybe the slightest whiff of sewage from the bathroom. Leo made his way toward the kitchen, sat at the table, and asked a few distracted questions about my family. 20 acres along the east shore, I said, when he asked about the range of our lot. They're mostly retired, I hedged, when he asked what my parents did for a living. Good for them, he said, cheerlessly, tucking a piece of graying hair behind his ear, like a girl. At the trial, the prosecution asked, Did you ask any questions in return? The prosecution asked, Weren't you curious about him? I was, and I wasn't. It was hard to explain how ingrained a habit it was to pretend I understood what was happening in other people's lives before explanations were offered. How I took in information differently. How carefully I watched Leo pour a glass of apple juice for himself and swirl it around without taking a sip. I watched as he set the glass down on a magazine, as he lifted the juice container Patra had left behind, and wiped the sweat from the bottom with his sleeve. I learned fast that he was finicky and earnest. His mind was not the marvel Patra had made it out to be, but exceptionally well-organized, exceptionally disciplined. He could make small talk with me about my parents, ask a reasonable series of questions, without seeming to take in my answers. The pattern of the conversation, the rhythm of small talk, he knew by heart. Better than that, even, he put me on guard, without seeming very interested, without ever giving away his true aim.
Do you have any siblings, then?
None.
But you're fond of children.
Well, some, surely. He raised his eyebrows, offering the correction to me. Then he smiled. As he did, his mustache changed shape, spread out across his face.
Paul says you've taught him to eat grasshoppers.
He's grown attached to you, it seems. He's gotten used to me, I said. You're being modest. I shrugged. He doesn't really have a lot of options.
He's a pretty particular kid.
Leo swirled the juice around in his glass.
And Patra says you've been a big help to her, too. She says she can't imagine what she would have done.
I waited for him to finish that thought. But he was finally drinking his juice, drawing it down in restrained swallows. As his throat worked, he seemed to be turning something over in his head.
How about this?
He set his glass down.
Why don't you come with us this weekend to Duluth? It would be nice for Paul, and it might even give Patra and me a chance to have dinner out or something.
I think she might need a little break.
What do you think?
By the time I went out with the soup pot of water, not even old Abe was waiting for me on the driveway. I'd been inside for more than 20 minutes. I'm not sure what made me think the dogs would just stay. I placed the pot on the front step for Patra to find and headed for the shore trail. I didn't bother to go back inside to say goodbye. I'd already made arrangements with Leo for the morning, and home was an hour away. Even in the shade of the dense pines, the day was hot, so by the time I got back I could feel sweat on my neck and in the wet patches of t-shirt beneath my armpits. My mother came out of the house wearing a smock that was smeared black with dirt. She was twisting a bud of loose skin on her elbow.
Oh, here comes Madeline. Oh, she decides to come back.
They're here? I asked. but I could see the dogs for myself chained to their stakes by the shed. They were standing up stiffly as I approached. Four bushy tails wagged low and fast.
"You know how traffic is on the 10 in June, don't you?"
She squinted at me, let go of her elbows.
"It's lucky none of them got hit. What happened? That you lost control of all of them at once?"
I was about to tell her about Drake, about rescuing the cat and returning him safe. But when I opened my mouth, something else came out.
"I was having a little adventure, Mom."
I watched her brown eyes squint at me.
"And this is part of it, actually, but it's the boring part between the exciting bits where the girl does the same predictable dialogue with her mother."
I got down on my haunches and roughed up Abe's neck. I heard my mom go inside, a single flap of the tarp. And guilt swooped over me in a way, like one of those birds of prey blacking the sun for an instant. Then I was just angry at the dogs, which felt better. I could see that their legs were covered in thistles and burrs. Their coats had dried in front, with spikes of mud. "You're getting wild," I told them. Which was true, I felt. I waited until I was done drying the dishes that night before I told my mother I was going with the family across the lake to Duluth for the weekend.
"Tell your dad," she said to that,
giving me a look I couldn't read. So I went out to the shed after the dishes were put away and sat with my dad for an hour listening to a ball game on the radio, Twins versus Royals. As we sat together on overturned buckets, my father drank three buds, methodically, measuring each sip, making them last to the final inning. Then he crushed the cans into discs one after the other, as the announcers described the weather in Kansas City, the heat wave that was followed by a thunderstorm, which had knocked out so much power they'd almost canceled the game. Almost, but not quite. I told my dad about going to Duluth just as he was standing up. He nodded, turned off the radio, and then pulled one more dripping can of beer from the cold lake water inside the cooler. As if reconsidering his prospects for the evening, as if changing his mind about something.
"That front'll be coming east by tomorrow night."
"I know."
"I thought we might get some walleye up in Gooseneck tomorrow."
"I know."
"The out-of-towners will be taking over soon."
"I know."
"Superior sure is pretty in a storm, though."
"Have you seen that?"
"Never."
They picked me up at 10 the next morning. I'd thought a long time about what to bring the night before, had laid out my second pair of jeans, and rooted through my mom's thrift store bag for something besides an old t-shirt to sleep in. I found a baby blue slip my mom had collected for scraps, and though it was musty and wrinkled and too big in the chest, I thought it might pass for pajamas. I'd also packed my toothbrush and comb, and right before bed, pumping well water in the dark, I tried shaving with my dad's razor. The hair on my legs was fine and long, and the first stripe that was gone felt magical beneath my fingertips. A track of shorn skin like silk ribbon from ankle to thigh. I'd finished most of the first leg before I realized there was blood from a cut I hadn't seen or felt in the dark. I could tell it was blood from the greasy way it slid between my fingertips, and how it smelled. I was too disheartened to do the second leg. Instead, shivering, I washed my hair with the last of the shampoo and a little bit of lemon dish soap. I rinsed caked mud from the soles of my tennis shoes and set them near the outhouse to dry, peed in that plywood hole, closed the door on the flies. I squeezed out the wet rope of hair that hung on my chest. When I slipped into the back seat of the blue Honda the next morning, Paul was asleep in his car seat. As Leo did a three-point turn, Patra twisted around and whispered from the front, "Good morning." She handed me a bran muffin, still warm, crumbling as I peeled open its waxed paper cup.
"Mmm, you smell good," she added.
My mouth was already full of muffin. The moist crumbs filled up every bit of space between my teeth and tongue, every empty place available. Patra grinned.
Good.
Eat up. Leo never likes to stop. He'll drive straight through anything, tornadoes, floods, breakfast, and lunch.
I stop. When we get there, just say where there is in advance and I'll stop.
Then there is lunch. There is sometime before 2 o'clock.
That's when there is, then. It's greed.
Once we got to the highway, all the familiar points disappeared within minutes. I saw the lake in flashes between the trees, blue-gray showing through cracks of green. In Loose River, we drove past the high school just when the sun broke over the tallest roadside trees, turning every surface into a flat knife of light. Stop signs and windows flared as we drove past them. Leo and Patra both wore dark sunglasses, but I just squinted, feeling dizzy and excited. Then we were on the interstate, going 70, and Leo and Patra were talking quietly about something I couldn't quite hear. I wanted to roll down the window, feel the speed on my face, but I held back. Late morning, Paul woke up sluggishly stretching. I gave him one of Patra's bran muffins, which he held between his knees, but didn't eat. His eyes were slowly unpinking.
"Are we there?"
he asked.
"Mm-hmm,"
I said. Outside, the pine forest was unstitching, opening into aspen groves and grassy farms dotted with hay bales. We played a half-hearted game of rock-paper-scissors. We played I Spy with my little eye. At one point, I said, "I spy a purple water tower." So Paul craned his neck to look out his window. His pale, sleepy face had a sunken look.
"I don't see it," he complained, setting his forehead against the window. "Let's do mental I spy."
"Okay." He closed his eyes and spied his own purple water tower. He spied his own iron ore train and Mars. After that, there was a long, indecipherable silence, while Patra fiddled with a car vent, while Leo drove through a brief rain shower, and somewhere just past the last farm, it occurred to me that Paul had dozed off again. I couldn't blame him. The car was warm and rumbling. Quietly, I ate Paul's muffin and watched the pine come back, rising up along the roadside in a long corridor of green. We hit construction outside Duluth. After an hour of sitting in traffic and dust, windows up, Leo pulled off the highway for lunch.
"See?" he said to Patra. "I stop."
We ate at Denny's, where I opened the huge glossy menu and ordered, after long deliberation, soup. I was nervous about chewing, about cutting up my food with a fork and a knife. Leo sat with Patra on one side of the booth, and I sat with Paul on the other. Patra guffawed when my French onion soup arrived in a bread bowl as big as my head. Warily, I prodded the thick boat of cheese that floated atop the brown broth. All around the restaurant, there were other families like ours, booths with two parents on one side and two kids on the other. Paul gulped down his glass of milk, so Patra ordered a second, shaking her head, laughing at me as I struggled with my soup.
"Want a bite?"
I asked, when she finally reached out and plucked the string of cheese that webbed from my bowl to my mouth. She wrinkled up her nose, bringing the freckles together into a brown smudge. Who could manage to eat that without looking like a baby bird or something? "A baby bird," she smiled. "Sucking up worms." Leo was a more focused eater, tucking his BLT into his mouth in careful sections. But once he was finished, he turned to me, wiping his mustache with a folded napkin, and within 3 minutes had asked me more questions than Patra had in 3 months. I let my soup cool as he spoke. I licked the salty spoon but did not attempt another bite of the cheese. It suddenly seemed too treacherous.
"What grade will you be in, then, Linda?"
"10th," I said. The question felt like a rebuke of the way I ate my soup, of my childishness. Leo pushed his plate to the edge of the table.
What college are you considering?
College?
Or, well, what subject do you like most? He crossed his arms on the table.
History.
I couldn't at the moment think of anything else.
Ah, American or European?
What historical period do you like?
The history of wolves,
I said. But the minute the answer was out, it sounded foolish. I sipped the tiniest bit of broth from my spoon.
You mean natural history?
Yep.
So, biology, actually.
Biology, I guess. His two elbows scooted forward, bumping his empty plate.
I had to take some molecular biology courses in graduate school. In my line of work, everyone is always looking for extraterrestrials, as if the universe matters only when endowed with a narrowly carbon-based definition of life. In the Goldilocks zone, I tried, repeating what Paul had said. Paul, who'd just left to go to the bathroom, clasping Patra's hand.
That's right,
he said, surprised. He folded his hands on the table, and you could see the straight planes on his fingernails where he cut them. I'm not saying the molecular biologists are wrong, he went on. That's not exactly what I'm saying. But I'm a scientist, too, and I think those folks tend to hone in on an extremely limited set of questions. He had a way of watching me very closely and not seeming to watch me at all. He was a teacher, of course, probably a good one. He was one of those teachers who set up hidden traps. Like all teachers, he wanted me caught, but he wanted to lead me there first. He wanted me to go on my own accord. He wanted me to feel like I'd made the discovery myself, that I hadn't been lured in. His chin was in his palm.
Let's do a thought experiment.
My parka slithered off my lap.
A scientist always starts with premises, right?
He twisted the wedding band on his finger. But so often they start with unsound premises and go awry. Like the world is flat, or the human body is made up of four basic humors. I wanted to reach for my parka, but resisted. But, of course, we've learned that if you want to be a real scientist, Linda, you have to be more rigorous than that. You have to figure out what your premises are first, before you decide what's true. A good biologist should always start by asking, for instance, what are the conditions we assume are required for life? And why do we assume that, and not something else? It seemed to be my turn to speak. He was waiting.
You have to ask yourself from the beginning, what do you think you know?
The 20 acres of land on the east side of Still Lake. That's what I knew. That's the one thing I'd always assumed I'd understand. I knew the red and white pine on the hilltop, the quaking aspen and birch closer to shore. I knew the honeysuckle and chipmunks and sunset views of the lake that weren't worth very much in the end to developers. When I had to sell off pieces of the lot at last, I got less than 60 grand, even though the market wasn't bad. We only ever had the 10 feet of pebbly sand to beach our canoes. The old commune bunkhouse, under a collapsed pine by the road, had long since returned to woods. For years my dad had pilfered its decent boards to patch his shed, fence the garden, repair the outhouse. The cabin was more substantial than the other buildings, at least, with its stone foundation and old-growth logs clear-cut in the 20s. We had a rocky meadow behind the cabin, and in summer a working garden. My mom's lettuce and potato plants enclosed in rusty globes of chicken wire. We had a cinder-block smokehouse and a good well. but the acres of woods were what I knew best. The big trees with their stippled trunks, red pine bark coming off in plates, white pine gouged by age into yawning furrows. We had 6 perfect black ash. We had 1 massive cottonwood. We had sumac blanketing the roadside hill, encroaching on the garden, arching over the dirt drive, until the county required that we widen the road. And we cut most of it down. Our hotel rooms in Duluth had bay windows and views of the lift bridge and the harbor, green hills rising up behind. The carpets and walls were uniform white, and in each room a red silk poppy stood in a vase on a lacquered desk. A mirrored bathroom connected our 2 rooms, with columns of creamy towels and soaps wrapped like candy bars. I didn't have anything to unpack. Instead, I climbed with my backpack onto one of the high, soft beds and watched as Leo and Patra moved between rooms unzipping bags. They were searching for Paul's socks, for his panda puzzle and hat, and as they did, I found my gaze drifting to a book on the bedside table. The Big Fits, it was called. A hotel book. I pulled its cool weight onto my lap, began reading about the taconite ship that sank in 1975. For a half hour, I turned the book's slick pages, studied black-and-white photos of the ship rising up from the waves and its eroded lifeboats recovered years later. I was especially interested in a huge diagram of the broken ship. The bow shone upright and turned the other way from the face-down stern. A lamp clicked on. The afternoon was darkening. I could hear Lake Superior lapping the shore outside, enticing, so I slid off the bed and moved across the room to where Patra was transferring yogurts from her cooler bag into the mini-fridge. I convinced her to let me take Paul for a walk by promising to be back before 5:30. 5:15, I revised, when I saw her glancing anxiously at the clouds out the window. "Let me get his jacket on, though," she nodded. "Let me zip him up in case it rains. Let me get his hat." Behind the hotel parking lot, I found a rickety wooden staircase that led down the steep, barren bank to the water. As Paul and I descended, step by step, I could see brown waves dragging stones in and out of the rocky cove. Gulls hung overhead. At the shore, lake water misted our knuckles each time a big wave broke. I tried teaching Paul to skip stones, but he just lobbed them in so they sank. "Like this," I said, curving my wrist and sending one out. Watching it bounce on the water 4 times, 5, 6, farther out, away from the shore. Lake Superior was a deep blue, almost black near the horizon. The Wisconsin side of the lake was hard to see. My dad was right. Night was arriving early because a thunderhead was advancing to the south. There was the trawl of stones and then a hiss as a wave withdrew between the tiny pebbles on the shore and another one came in. Paul had his hands in his jacket sleeves and even so he was trembling. His face was drawn and gray, the color of carp. It occurred to me then, as the waves picked up, that I hadn't really looked at him since morning. He'd been sleeping in the car, and when he was awake, he'd been turned into something of a pet by Leo, who'd carried him around, who'd talked over his head, who'd given him Lego bricks to play with. I bent down and looked at him.
"Everything okay?"
"Everything okay," he repeated.
"We should go in."
"We should go in," he said. His breath against my face smelled fruity, sweet. Inside again, Patra fed us dinner. She'd ordered room service for 2, grilled cheese sandwiches and chocolate milkshakes with bent red straws. Each of our rooms had a pair of queen-size beds, so there was a football field of bedclothes between us, a dozen blood-red pillows, bowls of peppermints and plastic twists on the nightstand. I sucked my shake in bed
and watch the weather channel on the big screen TV. The storm front, a pixelating haze passing to the south. It would just miss us, I saw, with the tiniest jab of dismay. Patra lay in the bed opposite. Paul snuggled in her arms. Eventually, Leo came in from the other room and tapped his bare wrist with a crooked finger. They had a reservation at the hotel restaurant downstairs, so when Patra glanced over at me, beached on my private shore of blankets and pillows across the room, I whispered, "Go." "Thank you," she mouthed. She kissed Paul, tugged at her drooping socks, and left the room. A moment later, Leo poked his head back in and said, "We'll be right downstairs if you need something." As if I didn't already know that. I crawled off the bed and crossed the room to where Paul was dozing, brushed crumbs from his covers, clicked off the lamp. Then I went into the bathroom and scratched open one of the tiny bars of soap with my fingernails. I didn't know how much time I'd have before they returned, so I didn't risk taking a bath, though I was tempted. Instead, I stood under scalding water in the shower for one magnificent minute, letting needles of water pluck open some feeling of woe, some feeling of desolation I hadn't known I felt. A capsized feeling, a sense of the next thing already coming. I toweled off, wriggled into the cool thrift store slip. I couldn't see myself in the mirror for the steam. I couldn't make out whether I looked more like a little kid trying too hard or a teenage girl with secret worries, like boys and college. Back in the bedroom, Paul was sleeping with his mouth open. I arranged my limbs on my own bed so they were splayed out, exposed. After a moment, I changed my mind and put my legs in a coil, and I waited for Patra to find me like that, curled up in my nightie facing the wall, unconcerned about anything. I didn't sleep, of course. I listened to the unfamiliar sound of traffic on the road and real waves, superior surf crashing into real superior boulders. I could hear the squeals of girls at the bar across the parking lot and the elevator humming up and down through the walls. When Leo and Patra returned at last, they left the lights off, so I never knew for sure if they looked in on us. The cool slip barely covered my thighs, and I was shivering by the time I heard a thump in the other room, followed by a stiff, muffled cry. My newly shaved leg scratched with goose pimples. It felt like someone else's prickly leg in bed with me when I brushed against it with my hand. "Ah," someone said through the walls. That's when I slid from the bed and crept through the bathroom in my bare feet. I nudged open the far door, waited, then looked in through the crack. It was dark, but the window blinds were open. A street light was shining in. At first I saw Leo all alone on the bed, sitting up at one end and looking out the window, as if waiting for some signal, some comet or celestial appearance in the darkness of the heavens over the city. Then I saw Patra on her knees on the floor in front of him, Leo's hand on her head, and so I thought of Lily and Mr. Grierson. They morphed there in the dark as I watched them. They were Lily and Patra, and Leo and Mr. Grierson at once. They were husband and wife. They were student and teacher. They were frightened bully and beautiful Lily. They were both. She looked so small on her knees on the floor, hunched over his lap. She gasped when she raised her head. "Come on, please," she panted. So I might have gone in. I might have interrupted them if I hadn't seen him push her head away, gently, the way you push an overly affectionate dog. If I hadn't heard her say to him, just as gently, "Stop being a baby, Leo." She was playfully mean. "Relax. I know you like that." I found out later that Lily had left town in May to testify at Mr. Grierson's trial. She'd gone to Minneapolis, where there was a federal court. But when she got on the stand, when the prosecuting attorney prompted her to tell the story about Gone Lake, Lily finally confessed she didn't know Mr. Grierson very well at all. She confessed
She'd never spoken to him alone, except for once when he'd given her extra time on an exam because of her dyslexia. According to court documents, the attorney pressed her on this. "Didn't he take you out on the lake?" the attorney asked. "Didn't you say that in your original statement?" He was flustered, no doubt, and had little patience for a victim who was going to take it all back at the last moment. He tried to convince her that she was afraid, that she was lying now on the stand. He asked the judge, "Why would she say what she did if it wasn't true?" Lily didn't answer that. It was a rhetorical question for the judge to consider, not her. "Here's the statement Mr. Grierson made in his plea bargain. I have done many, many things. Let me start again. I can't face my own thoughts. They are not thoughts I want to face, and it's just a relief. How do I put it? It's just a relief to have what I've feared the most said out loud. I'm ashamed, no argument, but I'm relieved, okay? I didn't touch that girl, but I thought about it. I thought about it. I thought about it. I thought about it. I thought out worse things than she said." In the morning when I woke up, Paul was gone. The door to the bathroom was shut tight. I slunk out of the slip and into my jeans and shirt, opened the bathroom door, saw through the tile and mirror corridor to where Leo sat in a cushioned chair in the other room. "Good morning," he said, glancing up from a book. "What are you reading?" I asked. To stall, to give me a chance to look around. I saw Patra's open suitcase on the closer of the two beds, the white strap of a bra draped out along with the mauve sleeve of a sweater. "Science and health." "Is that for your research?"
"No."
"Well, yes, in a way." As he spoke, I moved deeper into the room. I thought Patra and Paul might be huddled over a puzzle in the corner. They were not. Leo watched me eyeing the beds, eyeing the door, eyeing the suitcase.
"Linda," he said, "do you believe in God?"
I looked back at him.
"Just a question."
"Did you think at all about what we discussed yesterday?"
"I'm especially curious about that."
"What is it you believe?"
"That is, assume, to be true about your existence."
"That's the question to start with, of course.
What are your premises of self?"
"I don't know."
"You do?"
I crossed my arms.
"You do. That's the definition of an assumption. For instance," he coaxed, "are you an animal or a human?"
His legs were crossed, and he was jiggling one foot. He was wearing his black slippers, I saw, so he was the kind of man who packed slippers for a night in a hotel. He was a man who couldn't be without slippers, which made me sad and maybe a little repulsed by him.
"Or do you take for granted that you have a body?" "What age do you think that body is?"
One slipper dangled.
15.
The slipper fell to the ground, and he scooped it back on with a snout-like toe.
"So, then you assume your life began 15 years ago, and that it will end at some unknown point?"
"I guess."
"You assume that is a biological fact?"
I nodded, then shook my head, unsure what he was getting at.
"Now, ask yourself. How do these assumptions about yourself change if you take as your premise that there is a God?"
His slippered foot stopped jiggling. He'd gotten back around to where he started and could afford to linger.
"A thought experiment, okay? It's just logic,"
he murmured.
"If God exists, then what kind of God makes the most sense?
Either God is all good, or he is not God.
Either God is all-powerful or he is not God. So, logically, if God exists at all, then by definition, he must be all-good and he must be all-powerful, right? That makes sense, doesn't it? That makes the most sense. It did, for an instant. A gap slowly opened between his slipper and his heel. He pressed on. And if we're saying that God exists, if that is, God is by definition God, then there would be no place in the universe for evil, for sickness, for sadness, for death. There is only one premise that even makes God possible, so we've reasoned our way to the only possible answer. If, in the thought experiment, God exists, then how would that premise change what you assume about yourself? Where's Patra and Paul? They're fine. What's the most reasonable answer to the question, Linda? Where are they? We'll meet them at the harbor at 10. Let's get back to the question. Did something... I took a step forward. Did something happen? Linda. He parted the syllables very slightly, as with a comb. He pushed up his glasses with a touch of testiness. Maybe we'll have to talk more about this another time. That's fine. Maybe we should start thinking about getting ready to go? When I didn't move, he went on. Patra tells me you're very mature, Linda. A good listener. I watched him. Good company, she's always saying. And smart. But alone a lot, and I've seen that. I know that can't be easy. I know how it can make a person, a young woman, clingy. I felt my face getting hot, but I didn't say anything. Linda. He spoke so kindly now, so benignly and intensely at once. You'll see. I think you'll see that when you start with the premise we discussed, if you're intellectually honest and as smart as Patra says, you'll see that everything you think you know about your existence is wrong. His brown eyes did a mild blink behind glass. You're not lonely, really. My neck tensed up. You know, Patra told me something about you as well. Is that so? He was only somewhat interested. She said you're so busy with your work. My voice slipped on a wet spot in my throat. I steadied it back into words. She said you're gone so much that you hardly exist to her at all. He frowned. She didn't say that. Don't be dense. And because that wasn't quite enough to faze him, I sucked in a breath. Don't be a baby, Leo. That made his eyes widen slightly. That made him stand up fast, jiggle his pockets for keys, walk across the room to the closet. He wouldn't meet my eye after that. He just mumbled. Let's not be late, Linda. They took the car, so we need to walk. When I still didn't move, he said more insistently, We'll meet them at 10, okay? That's about 50 minutes from now, tops. It was irritating how he was closing the door on me before I was even out of the room. It was infuriating the way he kept skipping over now for then, his insistence I'd be reassured by Paul and Patra's appearance at the harbor at 10, almost an hour after I asked about them. But there they were, on a great wrinkled blanket on the grass. And I couldn't help it. I was reassured. Chapter 11. The wet grass in the harbor was tentacled in shadows from the passing ships. Paul and Patra sat sprawled on a blue cotton blanket with their legs open and palms back, looking up at the ships as they went past. Leo and I were late by mere minutes, so we didn't see the lift bridge lift. But we heard it clanging its warning across the harbor, and we saw the line of traffic backed up for blocks on Lake Avenue.
By the time we wound our way through the thick crowd, by the time we made it to the knoll beneath the bridge, the first of the ships were already sliding through the narrow concrete channel. They passed overhead in silence, a tall, tidy drift. I looked up and saw dozens of white sails, all gorged with wind. The complexity of their rigging was startling, but the boats themselves moved with gorgeous simplicity, as if, having discovered some trick, having determined the secret to motion, hurtling into harbor at 40 miles an hour was the greatest of all forms of stillness. There were 9 ships. The whole crowd seemed to hold its breath as they passed, the way people get when a green thunderhead looms, or when a moose with a weighty rack of antlers emerges from the woods. And then, just when the last of the ships slipped beneath the raised bridge, applause broke out. Not cheers, but appreciative, almost nervous clapping. People started checking each other, self-conscious suddenly, as if unsure what to do next. Gulls floated after the boats, wings curved open, unimpressed. Some children started chucking bread over the water, which broke the spell the ships had cast. We watched seagulls seize whole slices of white bread from the air. "How many boats?" Leo asked. I knew by now it was a habit of his to make a lesson out of this, out of anything, to snatch up every opportunity for improvement. Paul and Patra twisted around, noticing for the first time that we were standing behind them. Patra smiled her welcome, a slick of relief in her eyes. Now that Leo was here, she was ready to play the part of sidekick parent again, to pull up blades of grass with her fingers. "Did you see them?" she asked, folding a blade of grass back and forth, making an accordion of it. "Of course," he crouched down. "Hey, Paul, hey there, kiddo, how many did you count?" Paul hadn't thought to count the ships. There was a white hollow in his throat when he looked up at us. "9, I said. I felt the need, then, to defend Paul from Leo's good intentions. From above, from where I was standing, there seemed something funny about the way Paul was dressed. His steam engine t-shirt draped over him, bagged a little from the neck and shoulders. The toes of his blue Velcro shoes pointed inward. Leo said, "Paul, do you know what time period those ships are from?" I felt the need to jump in again, but then Patra opened a wicker basket on the blanket, revealing elaborate compartments for silverware and plastic cups, for cloth napkins rolled into tubes, and the feeling passed. That feeling was always passing. Patra swung open what seemed like a hidden door in the basket, and out came a silver thermos, which she tilted over cups, one for each of us. Lemonade. She peeled open a blue Tupperware, out of which gnarled strawberries bulged. "Organic," she emphasized, passing the container to me. I slid open a strawberry with my teeth and sat down next to Patra on the grass. "There's room," she said, patting the blanket. So I scooted in. Leo continued his lesson. "They're mostly from the 18th and 19th century. Do you know when that was?"
"Before rockets," Paul guessed, blinking his gummy lashes.
"Before cars," Leo said.
"And how many sails did you see on each ship?"
"They went by pretty fast," I intervened.
100,
Paul breathed.
14,
Leo said, a tyrant for facts.
"Or 11 or 8, depending on type."
Then he settled into an explanation about wind currents, top masts and topsails, traditional rigging and nautical miles. He wasn't preaching, exactly, just giving numbers, just enumerating statistics and particulars. Still, there was something pontifical about the way he talked, something lulling and insistent at once. And as he spoke, I rolled a single strawberry seed over my teeth, hard as a grain of sand, gritty as that, and as unswallowable. After a while, I stopped listening to Leo, who was advancing a method for converting fathoms to meters. I set the seat between two molars and took a sip of lemonade, waiting as I did for Patra to notice I was wearing her headband. I'd swiped it from the bathroom counter that morning on the way out. It was hard blue plastic with rows of tiny inner spikes. I felt like having someone's teeth against my temples. Uncomfortable, vaguely threatening, but reassuring, too. Like when a dog closes his jaws affectionately on your wrist and does not bite down, but could. My head felt different. I waited for Patra to notice my new head. But Patra had her eye on Leo, who, after finishing his speech about sails, had his eye on a tugboat coming into the harbor. The tugboat captain was waving from the deck at Paul, who, I noticed then, in a disconcerting flash, had his eyes on me. He was saying something garbled about Europa, where there was a sandbox with diggers, where nobody lived, where ships sailed around empty and lawnmowers mowed. In the Goldilocks zone, he said. Leo laughed, glancing at Patra in surprise. He's doing Europa and Illinois combined. He misses home, Patra explained, happily almost, as if she discovered the key to something. He just misses Oak Park, right? She looked to Leo for confirmation. Excuse me, said the woman on the blanket beside us. She stood up. She had a stack of paper napkins in her hand, which lifted up one by one like birds and fluttered to the ground. It seemed oddly coordinated, like a magic show for children, in which the trick was a simple application of gravity. I wondered if she was performing for Paul, who often got little performances like this from strangers. I smiled obediently at the woman, which was the wrong thing to do. She frowned and dropped the remaining napkins on the grass in front of Patra and me. "Excuse me," she scolded, barely concealing her disgust. And I saw then that Paul was throwing up in a bubbly white mass on the grass. Leo set his hand on Paul's spine, patted down very gently. The woman shook her head at us. "Looks like he's come down with something real bad." "Thank you," Leo said, politely. The sun kept shining and the wind kept blowing as we packed up the silver thermos and the Tupperware, the plastic cups we'd shaken out in the grass, the black cloth napkins. Patra and I put everything back in its compartment, in its loop of elastic, and shut up all the wicker doors. Patra's hands were white, but she wanted to put everything away precisely and in order, so we did. Leo carried a listless Paul to the car. As we followed across the grass, children ran in circles around us, chucking food at the seagulls. The children were hatted, shiny with sunscreen, laughing uproariously at the predatory gulls. They craned their heads back, lost their hats in the wind. More and more of them gathered in the spot we'd left open on the grass, and above them, the flock of gulls continued to grow. The birds were ravenous, undiscriminating. When I turned around for one last look, I saw the kids were experimenting. They were tossing into the air popcorn pieces and wax cups, carrot sticks, packets of gum, coins from their parents' pockets, handfuls of rock. That was June 20th, so summer was spinning around us in full force. The city was crowded with traffic and day trippers, white toy dogs on leashes, flower and popcorn vendors, kids on skateboards, old people with canes and walkers, corner ice cream carts. It was a snow globe kind of summer day. Seagulls everywhere floating down, the sky a dome of unbroken blue. One day later, on June 21st, Paul died of cerebral edema. This, I later learned, is similar to what climbers die of at high altitudes, and what deep-sea divers sometimes succumb to after they ascend. The brain swells and presses outward against the skull, and the optic nerves are under so much pressure they smash into the back of the eye.
The brain literally gets too big for the head. Crowds the plates in the skull, rearranges the gray matter. In his bed at sea level, wedged between his rows of stuffed animals and stacks of books, Paul probably had a terrible headache. He probably had a funny sweet taste in the back of his throat. He had diabetic ketoacidosis, I was later told. Later, I was told many things. That Paul had likely been nauseated and incontinent for weeks before this. That as his brain had started to swell in the last 24 hours, he went partially blind, lost consciousness, slipped into a coma. That while this last part was happening, he was left uncared for in his bed at the summer house. That instead of taking him to the hospital, instead of giving him the insulin and liquids he needed to survive, Leo had made pancakes and read him books, and Patra had tidied the house and emptied the litter box, and I had moved pieces around a Candyland board. His parents had taken him for a long drive in the car, while his babysitter had hauled into his room stones and leaves and pine cones. "I brought in yard waste," they said, incredulous. "What were you thinking?" I was asked on the stand. I could not bring myself to say that it was Europa's capital, that pile of leaves and rocks on the bedroom floor. I could not bring myself to tell them that what I'd meant to tell Paul, who, when I'd seen him last, had been looking out from his bed with just one open eye. Half his face had been smashed against a pillow. "No one lives in Europa," I'd wanted to tell him when he got back home. Not yet, maybe not ever. But the capital had been built, and there are trains that go on the ocean floor, and submarines and floating cranes, and it's not a city for people. It's not for fairies or aliens or anything cute and fantastical. It's just a city, I'd wanted to say. It's just a city. With trains and diggers and bulldozers and roads. This is how I remember leaving Duluth. Patra needed help folding up the cotton blanket, which we shook free of grass, and I remember how those blades were so green in the sun they were almost blue. When we got to the car, Patra and Leo had a short discussion about what to do next, and it was decided that we head back to Luce River early that afternoon. Leo wanted Patra to walk back and check out of the hotel while he waited with Paul in the car. They had a little argument about it, actually, the first argument I heard them have. They didn't yell at each other or raise their voices. They just stood on opposite sides of the car and squinted at each other in the sun, first disputing who should stay with Paul in the car and who should go back to the hotel and pay. And then, caught in the orbit of arguing, they switched right into bitter apology, Patra pleading, "I'm sorry, Leo," and Leo responding, "No, it's my fault. I shouldn't have let myself get upset over such a little thing. You stay with Paul. I'll go back." Paul sat this out in the back seat. I stood near him in the open car door, near him but not too close. He didn't want to be touched. "The weather is under me," he said, and I couldn't help smiling. "You're under the weather, you mean?" He was too busy drinking to respond. After taking a few sloppy sips of lemonade and then sweating instantly from the effort of this, taking a gulp or two from the plastic water bottle Patra produced, after dampening the whole front of his shirt with some combination of lemonade water and saliva, he set his head against his car seat, took a shallow breath, and closed his eyes. Patra sat in the back seat with him. She gave me the key, so I climbed in the passenger seat to turn on the air. It blew hot as breath for a minute or two, then gradually cooled, so we rolled up all the windows and sat in the chilled car, cut off from the summery world outside. I had the impulse then, as my sweat dried, to slide to the driver's seat and pull the gear shift into drive. It would be simple, I thought. How hard could driving be? "He's not himself today," Patra said from the back seat. I glanced back at her. I assumed she meant Paul at first, but she was staring out the window in the direction of the hotel. So it was Leo she meant. She unclasped her breath
the way people do when they're about to speak, then closed her mouth again, chewed on her lip. I curled around more fully, peeped at her over the seat.
"Is the temp okay?"
I asked, coaxing her out. I wanted her to unload her worry, like she did in the tent. I wanted her to need me for something she couldn't do herself.
"Yes, thank you. Thank you, Linda."
She gave me a smile that was all forehead. She was gazing down at Paul, who drifted off. She was petting his long, bare arm with one hand. I tested out her gratitude. "Do you want me to pull the car up a little bit? Do you want me to get out of this traffic?" Cars kept honking at us, hoping to get our parking spot. She considered it.
"Do you have your license?"
"No," I admitted.
"That's okay."
She leaned back against the seat and closed her eyes. And in the bright sunlight, I thought I could see her eyeballs moving beneath her pale lids. "Oh, there are her black pupils," I thought, triumphantly, frightened almost. But then she shielded her whole face with her hand, and whatever I saw was gone. She said, "Leo will come for us in a moment." I didn't like how she put that. I didn't like how confident she sounded. I didn't like how she changed with Leo around, how all her gestures were stretched out of size with a touch of performance. I didn't like how deferential she was with him, but also charged somehow, confident she could draw his attention if she wanted it. Her headband was making my head pound. I could feel its teeth in a cruel crown from ear to ear. I felt just miserable enough to take a swipe at her.
"Where'd you guys meet?"
Petra opened her eyes. She checked Paul before meeting my gaze.
"Leo and me?"
I nodded. "Yep."
"He was my professor."
I felt smug.
"At the University of Chicago?"
"How'd you know?" She'd worn that sweatshirt about 1,000 times. I shrugged.
"Astronomy 101.
She wrinkled her nose, making the smiley, rueful expression I was coming to recognize. She set her hand on Paul's sleeping forehead.
"I thought it'd be easy.
I thought we'd memorize constellations, learn the names of planets, that sort of thing."
"Did you?"
"We did some of that, sure." She caught my eye. "It's not what you think." I held her blue gaze. "What do I think, Petra?" She shifted in her seat, fingered Paul's hair so he stirred. For a moment, he looked hounded by his dreams. His face crumpled as if he might cry out. He didn't wake up, though. "I'm the one who stayed after class, who, you know, actually asked him out. It was me, not him." I waited for more.
"He was, like,
I don't know, he was bigger than anything else to me at the time." I found that hard to believe. I found it difficult to imagine that slippered, thin man leaving such a mark. He seemed insubstantial to me, though stubborn maybe, like a stain. I thought about how his heel had bulged out of his slipper, how the slipper was worn and black and ugly. Once, one of my friends at school ran into him on campus. She was collecting signatures or something for charity. And she said, "There's something unsettling about him." And I said, "I agree. He's unsettlingly smart." "He really is." She was justifying herself. She was making a case to me, setting up her defenses. She was trying to convince me of something, and as she spoke, I could see she was sitting up straighter, finding focus.
"Listen, Linda."
She was attempting to whisper, so her consonants got especially hissy.
"I'm not any good at explaining things. I'm not like Leo in that way. After the semester ended, I got him to sit with me in the cafeteria and eat a muffin, and he had a bran and I had a blueberry, and we did that again the next week and the next, and I remember how he tucked in his shirt when he stood up. You know how that is? How
You wait for someone to do this thing, and then he does it?
He tucks in his shirt the same way every time he stands up, and it seems, I don't know, like you don't have to go to all the work getting to know him because he does this thing